understandable. There wasn't in the during most of the campaign, there were no rallies on the part of the opposition because a demonstration in Ankara on the 10th of October had been hit by Islamic State suicide bombers. They'd killed 102 people. Earlier, there was another suicide bomb close to the Syrian border in Turkey that killed 32 people. So this made people very nervous. The fighting in southeast Turkey, where in Kurdish majority areas, that had been a sort of shaky ceasefire before this resumed. The Turkish Air Force was attacking the Kurdish guerrillas, the PKK so called, both in southeast Turkey and in northern Iraq. And people were watching on television every night the funerals of soldiers and police. So there's no doubt that Erdogan was playing the nationalist card and portraying the Kurdish parliamentary opposition as being hand in glove with people who are shooting Turkish soldiers and police. So you have this sort of edgy, fearful atmosphere. You know, we'll now see how long that goes on. Do things escalate? Do they get a bit quieter now? What does Turkey do over the Syrian Kurds, having taken over northeast Syria, and now they control half the 550-mile-long frontier with Turkey? Whatever Turkey wanted to happen in Syria, it certainly wasn't that.
Patrick Coburn, want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. His latest book is The Rise of Islamic State, ISIS and the New Sunni Revolution. He's been reporting on the elections in Turkey. His most recent article, which we'll link to at democracynow.org, President Erdogan tightens his grip on power in surprise landslide victory. And that does it for our show. We have a job opening at Democracy Now! We're hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. You can find out more at democracynow.org. Apply immediately. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineers. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becky Staley, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is more talk radio with our hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is scholar and activist Pramila Nadison, author of the book Household Workers Unite, the untold story of African-American women who built a movement about the little-known history of domestic worker activism in the 60s and 70s.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, November 14th and 15th, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first CMJ College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene in Portland. College Day aims to fill a day with great programming and speakers from and related to college and non-commercial radio, allowing both new and experienced voices from the radio world to talk about the issues that matter most to them. At this all-ages event, there will be live music, innovative workshops, presentations, and interviews with key members of the music and radio world from the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Again, that's College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cable Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO news director, Jenka Soderberg, in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
90.7 here in the metro area. 91.9 if you are in points east along the Hood River Valley. I guess I would say the Columbia River Gorge and the Hood River. There we go. No, Hood Mountain. You know what? Columbia River, leave it at
Columbia
that.
River.
And then there's the Willamette River Valley. Willamette. There we go. I don't know why I can be so eloquent right before this, and then I get Monday mouth. You are listening to KBOO at 104.3 in Philomath, and that is the Willamette River Valley. There we go. On the World Wide Web, it's kboo.fm. This is more talk radio, and we want to thank our engineer, our dauntless engineer, Steve Nasser, and the wonder dog, Koosh.
Thank you. Joining us this morning is Pramila Nadesan, who is the author of Household Workers Unite, Domestic Workers Activism in the 1960s and 1970s. Oh, you know, the untold story of African Americans who built a movement. It is a recent volume that tells us the story of people we do not often hear of.
Or don't want to see sometimes.
I don't want to see. And so we want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
I perhaps would like to begin by going to your epilogue. Because I think in it you talk about your family history and also your approach to social justice and how you approached writing history. Could you share a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, my family is from South Africa. I'm of Indian descent, and my four parents were brought as indentured laborers from India to South Africa after the British abolished slavery. So my great-grandparents worked on the sugarcane plantations in South Africa and were impoverished, living under apartheid. And actually, after beginning to write this book, I learned about my grandmother, who had worked as a domestic worker for a white family in South Africa. And my mother had also dropped out of school at the age of 14 and had begun to wash clothes for white families in South Africa. So that history and my mother's continuing participation in low-wage labor really had a big impact on my thinking about this work. But in addition to that, I have been very involved and engaged with organizing and activism ever since I was in college. And I was involved first in the anti-apartheid movement. And most recently, I've been involved with domestic worker organizing here in New York City. And there is a local movement, there is a national movement, and there is an international movement that for me really illustrated the ways in which workers are organizing, the ways in which these particular workers, who are often under the radar, who we often don't talk about as workers, are actually building a very broad-based, powerful movement to challenge, I think, some of the core features of this occupation.
And in this approach towards history, you know, you've written a previous book examining welfare, but also by focusing on people, as you suggested, who are not often heard from. And I wonder, as you approach, for example, the labor movement from the underside, looking at domestic workers, perhaps maybe we can get into this later, it can be used as a tool to organize others who are often not heard from. Traditionally, we think of the labor movement, and I think I've heard you in other interviews, by focusing on men, on industry,
mm-hmm. and manufacturing.
And you suggest perhaps a different way of looking at the labor movement.
Absolutely. I think so much of the way we understand the labor movement and labor history, both as scholars as well as ordinary people, is that it's very centered on a male industrial manufacturing model. And that is the history of labor unions like the United Auto Workers, which has an incredibly important history in the 1930s and the sit-down strikes, a very powerful movement that I think deserves recognition for what it did. But I think the problem is that that is not the entirety of the labor movement. That when we look at the history of other kinds of workers, such as domestic workers or service sector workers organizing, it really broadens our vision of what the labor movement is. And I think that's especially important in this moment when we see the number of industrial workers declining in this country, the number of manufacturing workers declining. And we're told over and over again how the labor movement is incredibly weak. And the private sector unionization rate, I believe, is something like 6 or 7%. And so we're fed this information, but I think if we actually look around us and we look at workers in different industries, whether they are adjunct faculty or whether they are Uber drivers or whether they are fast food workers or whether they are domestic workers, are in fact organizing and trying to collectively establish a better life for themselves.
You know, it's interesting that you mention such a broad range of workers and describe them as kind of being outside of our scope of view. One such subgroup is those who do caregiving. And I've noticed that they have been very prominent in the news, and it's also because I am active in my labor union as well, that you're seeing a lot of the same types of strategies to organize. A few moments ago, you mentioned that there were certain core features in these stories and in this strategy that they were that the domestic workers were using. And could you outline a little bit of what those core strategies are, so we can get a better picture of who these workers are and why they need to have myths about them basically diminished or removed?
Right, exactly. And I think that, you know, I think first, as you mentioned, what we have to do is look at the nature of this work, why this work is distinctive. And domestic work is, as you said, care work. It's also cleaning work. And it is work that historically has lacked recognition as legitimate work, in part because it takes place in the privacy of the home, so it's behind closed doors. Domestic work is also associated with women's unpaid labor in the home. And, you know, in fact, most of us do this work, and we don't get paid for it. We do it for our own families. So when we hire somebody to come in and do this work for us, it's not recognized the same way as other kinds of work. And domestic work has also been a racialized occupation. That is, there's a very long history of African-American women, as well as immigrant women who worked as domestics. And because of the way it was not recognized as legitimate work, it was also excluded from many labor protections. So in the 1930s, when most workers got minimum wage and Social Security and unemployment compensation, domestic workers were excluded from those rights. They have often been considered, as some domestic workers put it, one of the family. That is, employers would expect that these workers would do additional work, often with no additional compensation. But in fact, most of these workers expected and wanted to be treated as workers and to have the same rights and recognition as other workers. So when they set out to organize in the 1960s, they faced a number of challenges, one of which was that this was labor that took place in the privacy of the home. So how do you begin to organize workers if they're, I mean, you can't organize them in their place of work because they're usually single workers in a home. It's not like organizing people on a factory line or on a shop floor. So these workers turned to the public sphere, to public spaces as sites of organizing. And Dorothy Bolden, I think, is one of the best examples of this. Yes. Bolden was a domestic worker in Atlanta, Georgia, who was very involved with the civil rights movement, and she knew Martin Luther King quite well. So what Bolden did is she rode the city buses. She knew all the lines. She knew how domestic workers traveled from largely black neighborhoods in Atlanta to largely white neighborhoods in Atlanta. And she handed out leaflets as a way to organize women who were in this occupation. The other thing that these workers did is that they advocated state-based protections rather than employer-based benefits. And I think this also speaks very much to the current economic moment, and that is domestic workers very often changed employers. They might work for somebody for a few years and then be hired by somebody else. It's a very different model from somebody who might work for Ford Motor Company for their entire lives.
That was a very sophisticated detail that I think a lot of people don't really recognize the power of. Can you unpack that just a little bit about, you're telling us that because they moved from employer to employer, but what was it that really motivated them to ask or for to expect it to be a state-based? What was the thinking behind that? Because it's pretty sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there were a couple things. One is the ways in which, as a single worker in a single home, you're relatively disempowered. So if you can't really go on strike. If you go on strike, your employer will just fire you and find somebody else to replace you. So I think that's one key factor. I mean, if you're working in a factory with thousands of other workers and you go on strike, it's very hard to replace you. So I think because of that disempowerment, workers had to organize beyond their employer. They had to organize in conjunction with other workers who were employed by other people. That was one thing. And then the other thing was the fact that they did, in fact, change jobs very frequently and could be let go very quickly. So it required, you know, I think protecting women in this occupation required some kind of state intervention. You know, and that's a model that's being used by domestic worker organizers today because one of their key strategies has been state bills of rights. That is, having states pass bills that protect workers in terms of severance pay, in terms of, you know, their minimum wages, in terms of the kinds of living spaces they're entitled to.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott. I'm here with my co-host, Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Pramila Nadesan, who is the author of Household Workers Unite, The Untold Stories of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. She is a professor at Barnard College in New York City. And our numbers here are 503-231-8187 if you have a question or comment. One of the things that I think you do very well in this book is the means by which you tell the stories.
Yes.
You tell the stories of individuals and movements. And to help unpack the images we might have had of domestic workers, particularly domestic workers in the South in the 50s and 60s. So I would like to ask you if you would tell a story of some of these people in movement. For example, Georgia Gilmore and Club from Nowhere.
Or Dealey Cooksey after that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Georgia Gilmore. I mean, they're both really fascinating individuals. Georgia Gilmore lived in Montgomery, Alabama, and she, like many domestic workers in this period, had a number of different jobs and worked in a number of different kinds of places. And she had she rode the buses to work, as many domestic workers did in Montgomery in the 1950s, and had been very frustrated with her treatment on the buses. She herself began her own one-woman boycott of the buses well before Rosa Parks decided not to give up her seat on that bus and was arrested, sparking the Montgomery bus boycott. And more importantly, one of the things that Georgia Gilmore did is she decided she wanted to participate in and support and help to lead this the boycott in 1955. And so she began to organize other domestic workers. She reached out to them, encouraged them to participate, and began to raise money. And she did this the way, as a household worker, she knew best, and that was to cook food. She cooked food and she sold cakes and pies and chicken dinners and all sorts of things as a way to support the boycott effort. And these domestic workers went to the weekly meetings, and they donated sometimes $300, $400, or $500 to the boycott effort. And I think her story is especially important for a number of reasons. One is it shows us the ways in which domestic workers did, in fact, participate not just as foot soldiers, but as leaders in much Yes. of the civil rights movement. And I think it also shifts our narrative away from one of seeing the Montgomery bus boycott in particular as a male-defined narrative, as one that's centered on Martin Luther King. And it enables us to see the black working-class women who are absolutely central to making the boycott what it was.
Before we talk about Dela, one of the other things that I wanted to do was to talk about the fact that for a lot of people there was this thought that everybody who was involved in any of these movements were college educated or at least upper middle class or middle class within the black community. And the truth of the matter is we're dealing with some folks who not only are working class, but may not have as much education, but as you said earlier, were leaders and planners in this movement before some of the more familiar and famous faces stepped in.
That's right, absolutely. And many of the women, actually, I profile about 7 or 8 women in my book. And very few of them finished high school, let alone even went on to college. Most of them dropped out, which is why they ended up in domestic work. And I think it's not simply that they didn't finish college, but they were really, I think, brilliant women. They were brilliant women in terms of the way they were able to develop a national political movement. Mm-hmm. And by 1971, yes. they had an organization of 25,000 women across the country, which is an enormous amount. They lobbied to bring domestic work under federal minimum wage protections through the passage of amendments to the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1974. They were successful at that. They met with President Nixon. They met with their representatives in Congress. So they were enormously influential women who, I think, were able to overcome enormous obstacles in order to achieve what they did and to overcome a tremendous amount of fear. One of the women who I write about, Geraldine Roberts, talked about going to her first civil rights demonstration, and she couldn't even really understand the picket sign.
Yes.
But nevertheless, she was moved by a passion, a commitment to racial justice, and she stuck with it, and she went on to form a very important organization in Cleveland and remained active throughout her life.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. 503-231-8187 is the number. And we're very happy to take your calls. Good morning, Joe. You're on.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to say thank you for bringing this very kind of important history part of labor organizing's kind of larger mission and history to audiences. I wanted to ask whether you and the research you did and the domestic workers that or domestic worker organizers that you were learning more about, how did they register the parallel kind of feminist project of what eventually was called wages for housework and what would seem like a kind of competitive if they're working for wages for to do housework, how they responded and reacted and possibly supported or whatever that movement that would you know seek to recognize that the work that women who aren't already getting paid wages is, you know, valuable and part of the capitalist system?
That's an excellent question, and I'll start by talking first about the relationship of this movement to the more mainstream women's movement. And I, you know, as I think about the women's movement, I always think it's important to keep in mind that there were many, many strains and many competing perspectives within the women's movement. It was a movement made up of poor and working class women, middle class women, black women, Latina women. For the mainstream women's movement, I think there was a lot of tension between domestic workers and the mainstream women's movement. And part of the reason for that was many middle-class women defined their liberation in terms of taking paid employment outside the home. So for them, leaving the home and getting jobs outside the home was their definition of success and liberation. And this meant actually hiring domestic workers to do the work that they were no longer able to do if they were, in fact, in the workforce. And so there was a question of, well, how much do you pay somebody? And essentially, my liberation is dependent upon your exploitation. So there was a level of tension there that was inherent, I think, in the relationship. At the same time, the domestic worker rights movement did develop an alliance with certain components of the women's movement. And I think this was based on a common understanding of the way in which household labor for both paid and unpaid workers was devalued. That is, when housewives did housework, it was devalued, and when domestic workers did housework, it was devalued. And this had a negative impact on all women. And the wages for housework movement did in fact attempt to remedy this, because part of what they wanted to do was to have this work recognized as work and to be paid wages for it. And so there was an alliance there, and they did work together. I think part of the problem, however, was that domestic workers were already paid wages for this work. But the problem was not just the wages. It was the quantity of wages. It was the way in which the work was recognized in law and the amount they were paid for their labor.
Thank you. One thing that you also note is that you share about the power of these women as they battle common myths about who they were and what they did. Share a little bit about the movement to continue to paint domestic workers in the South as quiet, obedient servants. And, you know, I did not know until I read your book that there was a movement to put another image on the National Mall.
That's right. And it's the image of the mammy stereotype, and I want to stress that it's a stereotype, but this assumption, and it's very associated, very bound up with perspectives on African American women in the beginning of the 20th century. And that was a point when the occupation was largely African American. And so this image of the African-American mammy was a stereotype which suggested that African-American women were loyal and content servants working for white families. And it was almost a justification, I think, for racial inequality in the South at that time, in the assumptions that there was absolutely nothing wrong with the social order of Jim Crow segregation, where African Americans were given second-class status. And you're right, there in fact was a national movement led by the Daughters of the Confederacy to build a mammy monument in Washington. The African-American community was up in arms about this. And I think in many ways, domestic work and the stereotype of the mammy became a struggle about racial justice for the African American community, that in fact this image was so powerful that part of what African Americans and African American women in particular had been trying to do throughout much of the 20th century was to overturn the stereotype and to overturn these assumptions. And that was certainly part of this movement in the 1960s, is these women, for example, insisted that they be called household technicians. That was their term of preference. They didn't want to be called maids. They didn't want to be called servants. They certainly didn't want to be called mammies. And so the naming and the respect associated with the work was critical for their success in terms of in terms of trying to transform this occupation.
One of the reasons why I had kind of gravitated toward Dealey Cooksey was because she wasn't a learned woman, but she was very assertive in speaking out towards the identity and identity politics of the time. And even though it was a pretty short vignette, what I really liked was how you caught her story and how she really spoke up with regard to how she was being treated by her employer to her employer. And I think that is another way which you destroy the myths of that that placid, complacent mammy stereotype.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that, you know, there's a wonderful collection of interviews that was done during the Montgomery bus boycott, where some researchers had interviewed domestic workers who were engaged in the boycott. It offers us a completely different perspective on poor black women and on the boycott itself, because it does in fact suggest, I mean, so I think so much of the history of the Montgomery bus boycott is centered on the notion of respectability. And,
yes.
You know, and Rosa Parks was an incredibly respectable woman. And that's one of the reasons why she was chosen by leaders in Montgomery as a symbol for the boycott. But there were many black working class women who were not interested in conforming to a middle class notion of respectability, but in fact were very forthright and were very outspoken about their mistreatment over decades and about their vision for social change and social justice.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. We're speaking today with Pramila Nadasen, and the book she has written, which really uncovers a lot of the deep roots of the continuing black social justice movement, is Household Workers Unite, the Untold Story of African American Women Who Built a Movement. Join the conversation at 503-231-8187. As we move forward, I noticed that there was a interesting little chapter in here. Well, let me see if I can sum this up really quickly. It was kind of a juxtaposition or an intersection, maybe might be better, of the roles of women changing overall after the war, and the expectation that after the war, that middle class women who were no longer entering the labor workforce would spend more time with their children, spend more time in civic and charitable efforts, and be more of a homemaker. But even though that might have been the ideal, there were still women who did work in women's positions outside the home, such as librarian. And so I thought it was really interesting to see the intersection of philosophies and medical advice and social and cultural expectations play out in different ways for the white women and the black women, and how it intersected with ideas of how to train a workforce versus how to remain viable and get a good living wage. And I think one of the people that I wanted to talk, well, actually what I wanted to have you talk a little bit about was the NCHE.
Yes. I will talk about the NCAG, but I first want to address your comment, which I think is absolutely important in terms of sort of how we think about womanhood differently for white women and for black women, and that in many ways was really the crux of this conflict of the 1950s that you mentioned. In fact, white women were put up on a pedestal as mothers. That was their primary identity, and in many ways that was oppressive. You know, nobody wanted to be chained to the household as a mother. But nevertheless, that was their role. They were identified as mothers. They were expected to be mothers during the post-war period, whereas African-American women were rarely seen as mothers, were much more often expected to enter the workforce. And this was especially true of domestic workers, because these Yes. women very often had families of their own, but they left their children in order to take care of somebody else's children. And so in a sense, their status as mothers was almost erased from the history. You know, they're almost invisible as mothers, and their work becomes the most important thing. So, you know, I think the question of work and the question of motherhood is absolutely essential to how we think about the sort of different trajectories of black and white women. And there's a historian named Phyllis Palmer who I think put this best, where she talked about the ways in which, and the title of her book is called Domesticity and Dirt, about the ways in which the very definition of Victorian womanhood for white middle-class women was defined by the very dirty work that black women did for them. The NCHE was the National Committee on Household Employment, and that was the organization that really brought together domestic workers. But when it initially started, it was an organization of mostly white middle-class women who wanted to reform the occupation primarily as a way to expand the number, the pool of domestic workers, the number of domestic workers who were available to middle-class women. The organization was eventually taken over by African-American women and then worked to actually organize and to mobilize domestic workers.
Which is an interesting flip, if you will. You know, it's almost like a 180-degree turn from what it was.
That's right. That's right. And one of the women who sort of facilitated that shift was a woman named Edith Barksdale Sloan, who was an African-American, the first African-American woman to head the NCHE. And it's interesting to think about how and why she moved in that direction. I think certainly the larger political context was part of the reason, but it's also that she had a history of domestic work in her own family. And that was true of many middle-class African-American women in the 1960s and the 1970s. They had seen their own mothers and their aunts and their grandmothers labor as domestic workers. So they had a very intimate connection to this occupation, even if they themselves were not domestic workers.
I also found it interesting that the NCHE was interested in defining the nature of the work without a whole lot of input from the workers themselves. And I just kind of chuckled at the thought that, yes, I know you want your silver polished and placed in a certain fashion, and you want people who know how to set a table and what have you. But it was, once again, it kind of illustrated how invisible the black worker is when it comes to defining labor and the benefits of that labor.
Absolutely. So much of the training that the NCHE adopted was premised on this idea of making better workers by teaching them how to polish silver, by teaching them how to clean floors, and things like that. And so it was really for the benefit of the employer, whereas I think what you see happening by the late 1960s is the ways in which the workers themselves wanted to define their labor and wanted to define the value of their labor. So one of the things they developed are the contracts, and they wanted employers to sign contracts which specified what they would and wouldn't do. They wouldn't wash windows. They wouldn't scrub floors down on their hands and knees. And so they wanted a very clear definition of what they considered professional work.
And so to move beyond that myth oh, she's just one of the family. She's like one of the family.
That's right. To challenge that notion of the key concept of servitude, I think, suggests that somebody is there to serve you, to take direction from you, whether it's get me a glass of water now or sweep the floor at this moment, as opposed to the notion of this as a professional occupation where somebody actually has skill and knows what they need to do and will simply complete their tasks. And so I think the domestic workers saw this labor primarily as professional work that included a series of tasks that they were very capable of doing.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering, as you began your research on this movement, because I assume because it may not be as well documented as other movements are, you know, male-oriented organizing, what challenges you faced in getting to hear these stories, and did you have moments of frustrations or moments of revelation that kept you going?
I had enormous moments of frustration, many, and it is because there is so little documentation about women like this, and it's not only domestic workers, but I think poor Black women overall. So much of the historical narrative is driven by people who kept their papers and their archives, people who articles and books were written about or films were made about. And the fact of the matter is that very few people wrote many articles or stories about these particular women. So I had to dig very deep to try to find information about them. I was fortunate that there were a number of other historians who interviewed many of these women before they passed away. So I had access to a lot of their personal narratives. I did a lot of research in the archives that I had access to, and in terms of newspapers and things like that. So it was a very difficult movement to write about. I think my biggest regret is that I didn't learn enough about their personal histories, about their own children, about their own families. There are bits and pieces here and there. There is one woman whose name is Josephine Hewlett, who was a single mother, and she talked at different points about juggling work and motherhood, but I didn't learn enough about her life as a mother to be able to tell that story fully.
And one thing, you know, trying to learn these stories is so difficult, but also you mentioned, you know, a lot of these things aren't written down, so there's an oral tradition.
Yeah.
In terms of storytelling. And valuing that as an important way to uncover history, is that something that is valued by your profession?
It is increasingly valued. It's not valued the same way as, for example, presidential documents are valued.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of what I want to do with this book is to redefine how historians tell history. And so to look at different kinds of individuals and to look at what they say through a different lens. So that's one of the reasons why I use this theme of storytelling, because I do think we can't always rely on official government documents. And I put a great deal of value in the kinds of stories that these women told. And I think the stories that they told, it's important for us as historians to recognize how they organized, but it's also important to think about the meaning of their stories. So if I could just give you one example.
Certainly.
Geraldine Miller was a domestic worker who lived in the Bronx in New York City, and she had heard stories about something called the Bronx Slave Market, which existed not too far away from where she lived in the Bronx. The Bronx Slave Market was an area in the 1930s where African American women stood on street corners to be hired for day work. And two African American journalists, Ella Baker and Marvel Cook, wrote about the Bronx Slave Market and actually gave it that name. Geraldine Miller had never been to a Bronx Slave Market. She didn't experience it herself, but she had heard about the Bronx Slave Market from the women who lived in her neighborhood. And she took the story of the Bronx slave market and she told a story to other domestic workers that she was trying to organize. And what she told them is there were women who stood on the street corners in the 1930s, and employers would drive by and look for women with the most scarred knees.
Oh, my.
Because those women with the most scarred knees were the ones who scrubbed their floors down on their hands and knees. And Miller told a story not only to express outrage, but to also suggest to workers in the 1960s and 70s that they will never, ever scrub floors down on their hands and knees ever again. So the storytelling became a way to develop a political identity, but also to advocate for reform.
You know, in terms of advocating for reform, one of the things that I found fascinating that you mentioned was the fact that they required their employers to sign contracts as the movement progressed. Now, how did they leverage this power? Because once again, that's a sophisticated move, and that was an extremely important move for a group that up until this point, no one had ever looked at as being intelligent and organized and full of foresight.
Right. Well, the way they did it is through collective mobilization. So Dorothy Bolden, who I mentioned earlier, who organized domestic workers on the city buses in Atlanta, started an employment agency in Atlanta where she would ask employers to register and ask employees to register.
Mm-hmm.
And those employers who were particularly difficult to deal with, who were unfair to domestic workers, would essentially be blacklisted. They would the community of domestic workers in Atlanta was fairly close, so word would pass very quickly if an employer didn't pay fairly or expected work to be done that really wasn't in the contract. So obviously this was voluntary. There was no legal mandate that employers sign contract, but really through collective mobilization, women like Bolden were able to develop enough community support that I think it did put pressure on employers to think about the treatment of their domestic workers as well as the pay.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here as we interview Pramila Nadasen, who is the author of Household Workers Unite, 503-231-8187. Good morning. Barsh? Hello?
Ah, that's the button. Hey.
There hello. We go. Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A very informative show. Your guest has obviously done a lot of research, and I'm looking forward to reading her book. One of the things I was wanting to bring up is the problem with organizing. Well, one of the difficulties with organizing, especially back in the period of the 40s and 50s and into the early 60s, is that it was pretty easy to use the broad brush and say, oh, these people are agitators, they're outside agitators, and they're communists, and they want to destroy our way of life. You know, they want to change the order of things. And I wonder if your guest could speak to those points, if she thinks they're as important as I do. I'll just take that off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Mm-hmm. There was actually something in the 1940s during World War II where there was a lot of rumors about domestic worker organizing, and these were referred to as the Eleanor Clubs, after Eleanor Roosevelt. And it's not clear if, in fact, there were Eleanor Clubs, the assumption is that domestic workers were gathering in various towns and cities across the country, were refusing to cook, were refusing to do housework, and were refusing to use the back door. And I say that because I mean, whether or not it really happened, it instilled a tremendous amount of fear in the white community during World War II. So people were very upset about the possibility of domestic workers organizing. In the 1960s and the 1970s, there weren't a lot of charges about communist agitation or outside involvement in domestic work or organizing. I think there was more just a marginalization. I think there were people who simply didn't take domestic work or organizing seriously, even though it was, I think, a powerful movement. The labor movement largely did not support domestic work or organizing. So these women got most of their support from the civil rights movement and from the women's movement, from organizations like the National Organization for Women. So I think there was concern about the possibility that this organizing would transform a particular way of life that people were accustomed to. But at the same time that these women were organizing, we begin to see a number of immigrant women who are coming into the country, and those immigrant women are actually very quickly replacing African-American women as domestic workers. So, you know, I'm not sure that there was a real possibility of the destruction of this way of life as much as a transformation of the ways in which African-American women were treated as domestics.
With all of the research you've done and a lot of the personal stories you were able to capture, would you say that the movie that starred Whoopi Goldberg, The Long Walk Home, was a really accurate depiction of some of the elements of the Montgomery bus boycott and the lives of domestics, mm-hmm. as opposed to the movie The Help?
Mm-hmm. I think actually one of, I'll start with The Long Walk Home. I think that that film really centers on middle class women and their needs for domestic labor and the ways in which middle class white women in Montgomery actually put pressure on the city of Montgomery to resolve the question of the bus boycott because it became very difficult for them to clean their houses. So it's a story of alliance and support, I think, between white employers and black domestic workers.
And was that an accurate depiction, you think?
No, I do not think it was.
Okay,
I do not
good.
Think it was. I do not. I think there were certain elements. There were always individual white women who were supportive of domestic workers.
Yes.
But as a whole, it was not accurate. Mm-hmm. In the same way, I don't think The Help is very accurate. I think one of the things about the film, The Help, is that it continues the stereotype of domestic workers as disempowered,
yes,
as unable to speak up, as people who are victimized. And based on my research, I see, and DLZ Cook is one example of that, right?
Yes.
The ways in which domestic workers were able to speak out, were very forthright about their vision of how this occupation ought to be transformed. And so I don't think that black domestic workers in the 1950s and 60s needed white women to speak on their behalf. They were very capable of speaking for themselves.
And just to conclude this portion of the conversation, you know, there's this historical Hollywood love affair with the black servant, servile servant. Are you aware of any accurate or more accurate portrayals of household workers, or even, you know, you mentioned Gone with the Wind, but, you know, for 100 years, Hollywood have portrayed these people as disempowered, weak, and in need of salvation from someone else.
Mm-hmm. There, you know, the only there is not very much in Hollywood that portrays domestic workers as they truly were, which I see as intelligent, powerful women who are very capable of speaking out. So there is not a lot that's coming out of Hollywood that is giving us that perception at all. I mean, I think the closest I came to finding something was actually the sitcom The Jeffersons, where the maid in The Jeffersons is actually a very outspoken African-American woman, and she works for an African-American family. But in one episode, she actually joins an organization called the Household Technicians, which is the same organization that I wrote about.
Yes.
So I was very happy to discover that.
Excellent. I'm wondering, as the nature and the composition of the workforce change over the years, and you reference how in different parts of the country, different ethnic and racial groups of women perform domestic work, were there any challenges in terms of building bridges among either cultural or language differences, or even philosophy of the relationship between employer and employee?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were challenges, but I'll start by saying that one of the things that surprised me in my research was the ways in which the African American women leaders of this movement actually reached out to and attempted to embrace the immigrant workers who were entering the occupation. I think a lot of our assumptions is that African American workers and immigrant workers are always at odds, are always competing for the same jobs, are always trying to undermine one another, and that there's a lot of hostility there. But I found quite the opposite was true among these particular organizers. And that is they attempted to build a broad multiracial coalition. They wanted to include both documented as well as the undocumented workers who were becoming domestic workers. In reality, in practicality, it was very difficult to do that because of the language barrier, because of, the different cultural traditions. So there were attempts made, and there were alliances made with a few organizations that joined this national organization, but for the most part, it was not successful.
And as we move into the 21st century, and I think we referenced this near the beginning of our conversation in terms of the workforce today, what are, continuing lessons we might learn in terms of organizing workforce in today?
I think an increasing number of American workers today are experiencing the same kinds of conditions that domestic workers experienced in the 1950s and the 1960s. That is, workers increasingly today don't have health benefits. They don't get minimum wage if they're working as independent contractors. They very often don't get Social Security. They don't get paid vacations or sick leave. And all of this kind of, we can call it precarious work or insecure work, is a growing sector of the American economy. And I think it's reflective also of the conditions under which domestic workers labored in the 1960s and the 1970s. So I think we do have something to learn about how we can begin to organize this sector, a sector that is increasingly under assault, that is working part-time, subcontracted labor, contingent workers, and how people can begin to build a collective movement outside of their particular employer or even their particular occupation. And workers today are developing alliances across occupation and across employer.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We've been speaking with Pramila Nadesan, author of Household Workers Unite, The Untold Stories of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. It's recently published by Beacon Press, and I would encourage all of you to pick up a volume and to read about this fascinating piece of our history. And I look forward to reading more from you. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as we conclude this program, I want to remind those of you that coming up is the O Mo Variety Hour. Will Resnick interview philosophy professor Rebecca Gordon about negotiations to stop the killing in Syria. Tom Becker reads excerpts from The Elephant in the Room. Also, article is Bernie Sanders Dangerous to Socialism. This has been More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Thank you all KBOO members for your support. Remember, you may become a member or renew your membership by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. My name is Cecil Prescott, and for my co-host Celeste Carey, we wish for you a good day. We will speak with you soon.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of MAMI, an art exhibit at Yale Union in Portland. MAMI is a group show that considers the mystery and chaos of motherhood, and in reaction to the sentimentality and laments the culturally constructed binary of, quote, family versus career, while acknowledging the persistence of that obstacle in the lives of artists. Again, that's MAMI, showing Thursday through Sunday, 3 to 6 p.m., until December 20th at Yale Union, located at 800 Southeast 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month is the amazing Nina Simone, showing Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. Nina Simone was one of America's true musical geniuses. With her unique signature mix of layering folk, gospel, classical, pop, and African music, along